Welcome to episode 127 of the Big Rhetorical Podcast. I'm your host, Charles Woods. Episode 127 of TBR Podcast is a special episode. This episode is a best of episode of the podcast. An idea conceived of by the undergraduate intern, Brandon Ying, working on the podcast this year. This episode features clips from episodes across the first 8 seasons of TBR Podcast, including interviews with conference organizers, graduate students, and activists and authors. This best of episode was produced by Brandon, and you'll hear more from Brandon later on this season on TBR Podcast. Now, instead of listing the scholars who you're about to hear, I want to encourage you to tag them if you recognize their voices in posts on Facebook and or on Twitter or even on TikTok, where you can find TBR Podcast at The Big Red. Please share this podcast episode as a way to amplify the hard work of student podcasters like Brandon, to acknowledge their hard work and their dedication to their studies and to their practice. Brandon has done an incredible job here. I hope you enjoy the interview.
Like, my family was the classic, like, no drinking, no swearing. Yeah. They allowed dancing, but only to a point, right? But, like, my parents, they still don't, like, they do not drink. And they are, like, they're the classic Southern Baptist that, like, people think, oh, that's just what you see on TV. No, it's not what you see on TV. Like, I grew up that way.
For me, you know, so, I think, oh, no, go ahead, please.
No. What were you going to say?
Two professional podcasters talking all over each other.
Yes.
Right?
So it was just going to school and seeing that, like, not everybody lives that way and that there were multiple options to approach the world was eye-opening. And the fact that I saw that even at an institution like Baylor was, yeah, like, obviously the world is different than what I thought it was.
Do you feel like rebelling against your religious upbringing was one of the healthiest things you've ever done, and, like, putting things in perspective, or is it still something you struggle with? That may be a loaded question.
No, that's okay. I don't mind. I don't know. So I don't know that I like the word rebelling because I still am a person of faith. I go to an Episcopal church now.
Gotcha.
I still consider myself a very religious person. I have not given up on that. I've just sort of revised the way I see things.
I love that.
So I don't know that I definitely didn't grow up into the kind of faith that I was raised in. But I like the philosophy and I like the basic tenets of the faith. I mean, help the poor. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Be kind to each other. That's a good idea. Like, there's not a part of me that wants to give up on this. Because I think there are some good ideas there. I just had to find a place where those good ideas I felt like were put into action a little bit better.
Thinking about your book and reading your book, I noticed like there were three ways that I was thinking about this, these things coming together. Pedagogy, right? Which is, I know, is extremely important to you based on the roles that you've served in during your career. And then production, okay? Like, what are we producing and what are the elements of that production in terms of connecting to the writing process, if you will, right?
Yeah.
And then also creative endeavors or pursuits like filmmaking in terms of scholarly production that might count for something like tenure, right?
Right.
So those are the three things that I think we might, the three ways we might approach, right? The three dimensions we might approach talking about filmmaking.
Yeah.
Does that sound good to you?
Absolutely.
All right. So when did you first, this is going to sound like the most cliche question.
Okay.
I would laugh if someone asked me this question, perhaps. When did you first fall in love with filmmaking and the movies? What was it? Was it a specific movie or star, maybe?
The movies itself, it was noir. It was it was Casablanca. It was, and then it was any other sort of black and white film from the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s that I saw on Saturday morning movies. And, you know, my sisters would get up early to watch Little Rascals, which just drove me up the wall. I know lots of people are big fans, but every time I hear I am the Barbara Saville, I want to scream. And they just, it's like they revel in it. But so I was waiting for, you know, for my chance with the TV, because at the time we had that one screen so I could watch old movies. Cinematic smoking was appealing to me. Unfortunately, that wasn't a great thing for a young child to be drawn to, but cinematic smoking just looked so slow and contemplative. And I was raised in just a chaotic family of five girls. And there was a lot of chaos in my house. And just the slow, deliberate pace of the delivery of dialogue. The way a cigarette could sort of slow down a scene in a strange way and sort of ground a person and reorient them to the space. And then in particular, I really always loved the way that blinds were used, window blinds were used to cast like a sense of moral ambiguity on a character going through some thought process. As a kid, I didn't know that's what I was loving. Later, I realized that's what I was loving about that. Bogart, Kate Hepburn, Audrey Hepburn, Ava Gardner, oh my gosh, what's her name? Barbara Stanwyck, Betty Davis. Come on. I know I sound like Madonna doing my song, but but these are these old black and white movies that I just I was drawn to. And I've never really taken a ton of time to figure out why, except for those few things that I mentioned there. And I do write about that. I gave a paper, I forget when, but it was 2007 at Four Seas, and a huge ballroom. I was on this panel with Anne Wysocki and Jeff Zirk. Oh my gosh. And talking about film, and I began to explore this early love of cinema. So I did write about it and talk about it, and it is in chapter 3 if you wanted to, you know, follow up and look at that. But later there were other things. Later there were other films. But eventually, let me fast forward and say that when it came to production, it was my work with Sundance that made me decide. I always wanted to be involved in film. I, like many wannabe actors, imagine giving my Oscar speech. You know, this was a big feature of growing up. And but when I started working with Sundance, and I was the liaison between the talent that came with the film and the audience, and I got to talk routinely with actors and directors and producers, and I'd see them go up on stage, and I'd stand off to the side while they were giving their answers in a Q&A, and half the time it's like a 20-year-old filmmaker, and a very common question an audience member will ask is, how did you get, what made you want to make this film? You know, why were you so drawn to make this film? And then And there was a very frequent answer, especially a documentarian would say, the story just came to me. It just sort of fell in my path and I had to make it, which sounds very magical and mystical. And like, as a person who strategically wants to do things, it's like, that's not an answer.
as somebody who's more mature, I'm 42 years old now, and I've been doing this for 20 years, like I said. And, you know, you don't realize the type of influence you have sometimes when you're doing the work that you're doing, and you make irresponsible decisions with your power. And, you know, part of that for me was, you know, it's just my history. I'm a redneck auto mechanic from, you know, Birmingham, Alabama. And I always saw myself as just a regular guy. Like, I'm just some dude, you know. I don't know why people listen to me or anything like that. And it's taken me many years to realize that, you know, I'm not some regular guy.
Yeah. Let's talk about that term redneck. You describe yourself as a mad redneck. What's that term mean to you? How do you like interpret it in your life and use it? What does it mean to be a redneck?
It means to be specifically and technically, it means to be a white working class Southerner. But if you look at the history, the Battle of Blair Mountain, like the sort of technical apolitical version of it is that it's a white working class Southerner. But if you look at the Battle of Blair Mountain, which happened in 1920, it was the largest armed uprising in the United States outside of the Civil War. And it was the first aerial bombing by the U.S. government in the history. It is the first aerial bombing by any government in the history of the world. 10,000 miners rose up against the company and the Pinkertons. And they wore red neckerchiefs around their necks to symbolize solidarity. And it was a multiracial and diverse group of people. It wasn't just white people. It's come to mean white people. But they were all rednecks. And so to me, redneck also means that you fight for what's good and that you're a resistance fighter. And I would like for that definition to reemerge in the South and really all over the world. To me, redneck is a global identity. It's not an American identity. And I think of the American South as really not even part of the United States. I think of it as a part of the global South. And I think, you know, some of the stuff we've been doing these Deep South roundtables where we get people from all over the world talk about their experiences in their lives. And, you know, you start to see, you know, what's going on in South Africa with mining and natural resource extraction and so on and so forth. It's not that different from what's going on in the American South. And, you know, we've kind of got together and we're starting to see that, hey, we got a lot in common. So I think of the American South and rednecks as, you know, part of this global network of resistance fighters fighting against basically the empire. And we're sort of in an interesting, the American South is sort of in an interesting position because we are inside the empire. Rednecks are inside the empire. And we do have a resistance tradition to empire that we need to reinvigorate. And so we're in this sort of interstitial space between the global South and the empire. We're inside the empire, but we're an internal colony of the empire. So it puts us in a really interesting position in terms of geopolitics. So, you know, I think a redneck in that way is like, hey, we're part of a global community of people who are fighting against empire. And admittedly, that's speculative. Okay. That doesn't exist right now. That's not real right now, but it could be. And, you know, I think that's some of the work that we're trying to do is to try to push people to think about stuff this way. Hey, after what happened yesterday, I had conservatives calling me, man, this is how you take down capitalism, using those words, conservatives using those words. This is how you take down capitalism. And
talking about the GameStop trading, right?
About the Redditors trolling GameStop and breaking hedge fund managers. And, you know, they're excited about it. And
what do you think about it?
Oh, I love it. It's just awesome, man.
One of the things I really wanted to do with this work is to draw a through line from scholars like bell hooks and other Black queer feminists to say, like, some of this work has already been done, and it's just about seeing it in the light of these new forms to say, like, we can draw a line from rhetorical communities to possibilities of better material worlds. My other fun thing that I do is I talk about memes as citation and the ways that that citation is a rhetorical move in and of itself. And I think that in particular is exciting, I guess.
So do you have like an all-time favorite meme, or maybe it's best to ask, do you have a favorite meme right now, or one that has unique power, right? As you were talking.
So that's actually really funny that you ask that, because in my participant interviews, one of the things I ask is, what is your favorite queer meme? And the number one response was always, oh my God, that's such a hard question. Give me a minute. I will say, I don't know if I have a favorite meme of all time. I do have like a favorite meme flavor, I guess, which is I love a good deep fried meme.
Okay. What is that deep fried meme?
A deep fried meme is like, usually there are several layers of memeage to it. So it's a meme that often references at least one other meme, if not more. Sometimes they'll have this purposely DIY'd look to them. So they'll have been done in MS Paint instead of a meme generator. They don't have the clean look of like traditional image macros. They might have purposeful or not purposeful JPEG compression. And they often, they're interested in, and this is like my visual culture coming out. I love those because there's something about the ways they are both purposely and not purposely representing like the machine-ness of them. They don't let you ignore the composedness and the ways that machines modify visuals that I just find really fun and interesting. The same way that like I find zines interesting because you can't ignore the handedness of them, the handmadeness. This is like the digital version of that handmadeness. You can't sort of ignore the compression. It's such a visual cue to the material reality of its making. I think my husband hates that this is the meme I love right now because he can't stand the audio, but my favorite meme right now is the TikTok audio, where for some reason there's not even that many videos for it. I think TikTok just knows that I like this kind of stuff. It's usually an overlay of like a cat or some other like weird video sometimes. And the audio is just, you smell like a baka, Eren Jaeger, which is, Eren Jaeger's an anime character from Attack on Titan. And baka is the Japanese word for like idiot. So I've just been saying that all the time around the house. My husband's like, stop telling me I smell like a baka. And I have no idea. I could not explain to you for $1 million why I find that as funny as I do. But that is my favorite meme right now.
Another one of my mentors, Dr. Matthew Vetter, he's also been helping me with the Wikipedia initiative. Him and Dr. Driscoll actually had a PowerPoint they created. It's a huge folder that has all these different job materials from previous students in our program who've successfully gotten a job. And that was very helpful because before the job market, right, there's so many different documents I was not aware of, right? So I knew of the traditional, you need a CV, you need a cover letter, you need a resume, but I never heard of a diversity statement until a few months ago. And I didn't know what a diversity statement should look like until I saw the models in the folder. I also didn't know that for a lot of writing center jobs, they want a writing center administrator's, you know, not I wouldn't say portfolio, but they want a 1 or 2 page document about why you're an effective administrator. I also didn't know about the teaching philosophy until I got on the job market, and there's all these documents to keep track of. And I felt very overwhelmed, but because Dr. Driscoll, Dr. Vedder, and the rest of the Cal department really took the time to make this folder, we have all of these different resources that people can refer to when you're on the job market. I would also say that there's a very helpful PowerPoint in this folder, and I'm sure I can share it with anyone who's interested, where they talk about like the 2 to 3 minute elevator pitch. So when I was doing my interview for UNLV in particular, you know, I had to do two rounds. I did the first interview with three people, the Writing Center director and two, I think it was associate or assistant professors. And it was basically four questions, but I had to have my answers prepared. And I spent the entire previous day preparing the answers. And, you know, I think the general model is, you know, they ask you the question. I think the biggest question that came up was diversity, right? So like the question would be, how can you help improve diversity on our campus? So you would say like an opening line that showcases you can improve diversity. Then you need to talk about your previous experiences, Writing Center or teaching, you know, for the next few minutes. And I think the biggest piece that I didn't know beforehand is that you need to connect it back to the university's mission. So what I did in the interview is I was very prepared on what the UNLV Writing Center is currently doing for research. I also knew the institutional outcomes. So if you go to like the UNLV's, you know, page, they outline here are our four outcomes. Here's the master plan. Because the biggest piece of advice I got from Dr. Driscoll, and I think it's helpful for any future administrator, teacher, is that you have to align your goals of the Writing Center or any institute or any department with the goals of the university. So if you're not able to successfully, you know, demonstrate how your teaching position, the Writing Center or administrative service, if you can't connect that to the actual university, it's going to be very hard for you to, I think, succeed in the job market. And that's how I think I succeeded well in the first interview. I really followed that 2 to 3 minute elevator pitch. And I didn't make myself sound nervous. It was just very rehearsed. And I think it's just also like doing some research on the actual faculty, because I knew who was on my committee. Like they gave me that information ahead of time. So I made sure I went to Google. I wasn't stalking people, but you know, everyone's information is pretty public. You can find their CVs. And also my current director, she posts a lot in that Facebook page I mentioned, the directors of writing centers. So I just made sure I knew like kind of what it was she was currently working on. And then I brought that up a lot in our interview. So she was asking me questions about, oh, so like, how can you help with the UNLV Writing Center? And I would have been like, oh, you actually, you know, a month ago, you had talked about how the UNLV Writing Center was really struggling with this issue. And I have a workshop today for my interview that can help maybe address this problem. So I think it's being well prepared, you know, being friendly, and I think just look up the people who will be on your committee. If you know that information, I was very surprised how easy it was to find everyone's research opportunities, even yours, Charles. Like I can, you know, put in, you know, Charles Woods and, you know, Red and Comp or Charles Woods, the Big Rhetorical Podcast. And like your research comes up pretty clearly on, you know, ECU's websites. And I'm sure if I talk to Morgan or others, they could tell me more about you too. So I think if you take the time to get to know people who are on the committee beforehand and you can show that you care about their research, I think you'll be in a good place.
So when we think about your dissertation project, Bo, from a historical perspective, like what do we need to think about that moment?
So I love answering this question because it's such good practice for job talks and elevator pitches. But I can tell you that my dissertation historically is located at a moment right after the Spanish-American War. So as is taught in many American public schools, the Spanish-American War is when the U.S. was able to acquire some of Spain's territories, right? So that's Cuba, Guam, Puerto Rico, and part of that purchase was the Philippines, which had been a colony of Spain for about 300 years at that point. And so the Spanish-American War and the events shortly after that precipitated Spain handing the Philippines over to the U.S. in about 1898. So the U.S. has this new group of islands in Southeast Asia, halfway across the world, and they're like, what do we do with these people? Should we uncolonize them? What's it like? And one of the projects, I would say that the big sort of theme for American colonization back then was a policy called benevolent assimilation, where they decided that it would not just be a military campaign, but it had to be an ideological campaign. Part of the ideological campaign was putting up a system of public schooling that introduced English to the Filipino people. So in 1901, the U.S. decided to send hundreds of teachers on two ships. Well, the biggest one was called the USS Thomas. So they sent all of these American teachers that they had picked through a civil service exam to the Philippines to put up the first public schools. So I think a contemporary analog to that would be, I mean, it's not an exact match, but would be like the Peace Corps or the Fulbright English language teachers who are sent from the U.S. to other countries in order to promote English, promote American values, et cetera, et cetera. So these teachers came on this ship and they came and there was very little waiting for them. So these teachers were literally building the schools themselves. They were requesting equipment, requesting books, pencils, paper, and they were also entering a political situation where Filipinos, I think, were very uncertain. Or no, I don't want to say uncertain, but I think there was a lot of division about what direction the country was going to go in after being quote unquote liberated from Spain. So there was a lot of Filipino resistance to the American presence. And so American teachers were entering, I would say in many parts of the country, hostile territory. And so the student writing that I'm looking at, they are examples of student compositions written under the supervision of an American teacher. I still actually have not identified who the teacher is. The archive is the personal papers of Frederick Boehner, but so far, the years when Frederick Boehner was in this area of the Philippines don't match with the years that the students are writing on their essays. So the teacher could be somebody else. And I think Boehner was the principal, but I don't know who is writing back to these students because there are marginal comments and like scribbles in the footnotes and corrections. And I don't know who the teacher is. But the students are writing about a range of topics. Some of them are very political. Some of them are writing about the history of the Philippines and colonization and their hopes for the future and what's it like to live under an American regime. A lot of essays are on folklore, on science, on what they're seeing, the progress that they're, the quote unquote progress that they're seeing. And so my research is really interested in digging into this moment and in digging into this connection between U.S. empire, education, and writing, how there is a history of writing that is directly tied to U.S. colonization. And again, a moment that maybe not a ton of people in the U.S. are very familiar with, and see how writing has actually been used as a tool of colonial ideology.
In that way, I guess then your conversation for me, like you said, I don't know anything about this. I'm really enthralled though. It seems like this project enters into and contends with other conversations in post-colonial rhetorics.
For sure, and I think it engages with decolonial rhetorics as well. I'm currently describing my work as post-colonial. It's engaged with conversations on post-colonial and decolonial rhetorics. I think that's fair to say. And I think that I don't know what the end point of the dissertation is, but I think that the students are showing what's it like to write in situations of unfreedom and how even when you're not free or even when you are othered, you can still and you do still push back.
Let's talk about what it means to be good, to do good. In your book, you write about your father and his ministry, and you ask, quote, "But is it enough to be a good man, a good person? Are there not times when you must say and do more? Are there not moments in history when you must take your fist or your head and pound on your podium, on your pulpit?" Two tough questions. Now that the project is complete, what is your perception of good white men in the South during the civil rights movement? And what does that even mean? Do you see your book as performing the work your father could not or would not do at a time when America is in flux culturally?
Make sure I don't forget the second part of that, because it's a great part of the question. But well, I'll go ahead and answer it, and you can ask me the first part again. You know, I think it sounds a little arrogant to say that I hope that that's true, that this does carry on and maybe fill in the gaps from when he wasn't sure enough to speak. And in some ways, I do believe that. I mean, not in some ways, I truly do believe that. And I feel like, and I mentioned this in the book, it was one of the most remarkable things when I looked back on it, that was not one of those remarkable things when it happened. But the last time I saw my dad alive, he was in hospice and I went to see him and we talked. He could barely talk, but one of the things he did was to reach over and grab me by the hand and say, you know, that he was proud of me for taking on issues of race. And because I had really recently written some things about it and always do, because I live in Birmingham and, you know, it's relevant all the time. But I mean, I didn't really think about that at all at the time, because I didn't know at the time that he had struggled with those issues so greatly. And I feel like that the way he reached out to me and the time in which he reached out to me meant that it was something that bothered him. And I don't know that he would be happy that I put it all in a book that's being, you know, that questions his own strength, but I think that he would be really happy and supportive of the overall message and the way it seems to, in most circles anyway, by people I care about, seems to be understood that it is about love.
Let's go back to the first part of that question you told me to redirect you to.
Okay.
Now that the project is complete, what's your perception of good white men during the South, in the South during the civil rights movement? And what does that even mean?
Well, I mean, it means there's a lot of failure there. And if I think of, I mean, even among the people I most look up to, I mean, including my father, but there's a man named Charles Morgan, who I quote in the book, who's a lawyer. And on the day after the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, in which four little girls were killed in September of 1963, he went before he was scheduled to speak at a downtown civic club in Birmingham, and he gave what I consider to be the most beautiful speech I've ever heard. I mean, I think his family let me include it in its entirety in the book, which I appreciate. But every time I read that speech, I cry, because it is so true. I mean, it is about who essentially is responsible. And the answer was, you know, everybody who refused to speak up, every church who refused to respond, every preacher. I mean, he goes down. I mean, it's a long, beautiful speech about responsibility beyond ourselves and our own homes. And even he was too late. I mean, he went on to do amazing things. He was run out of town. But, you know, it's those people who, and you know, my dad was a good, I mean, I don't ever resolve that question. My dad was a good person. He helped anybody he could help. He integrated scout troops and made sure that I understood the way the world really was. And his failures again were failures to speak from that pulpit. But I think if we're given an opportunity, I mean, and this is largely because of the, again, I've said this, I'm sorry to repeat myself, but it's those moments of little silences that haunt me. And to just think that you didn't say what you needed to say to try to, you know, make the world just a little more fair, I think is goes a long way to goodness.
I just sent a link to you for the online teaching page, which is still evolving. But we have just like a listicle of like top 10 tips for teaching online. We created a type of decision tree where we say, do you do this in your face-to-face classroom? Here's how you might do it online. There's a help guide to distance learning. That's a shorter version of a teaching guide we've been working on for the past 2 years as we created and iterated our online first year writing class. And then just a directory of staff. Like, do you have a question about video conferencing? Here's people who have experience with that. And that was born out of our crowdsourced collaborative professional writing and first year composition minds all in a room.
You have a considerable amount of experience teaching online.
Yes.
And now you have a considerable amount of planning for moving a ton of courses with a ton of different instructors online. What would you say instructors should consider in terms of managing expectations, both their own expectations and the expectations they should have for their students while we're in this distance learning pandemic mode?
Yeah, what an excellent question about managing expectations. I think that the first thing, and it's great advice for everyone to keep in mind at this point, is that we're in an unprecedented moment, the likes of which none of us have ever seen before. And because we're in this unprecedented moment, tensions are running high, drama abounds. And so just exercising care and mercy with each other is the most critical thing, I think. And I say that having also been really short or stressed out sometimes over the last few days, that I have to remind myself, if someone gets grumpy with me, or if I'm starting to get grumpy, right, this is... we have no handbook for this. We have no precedent or antecedent to look at about this. So exercising mercy and care is really critical. And I have been really happy with a lot of the hot takes on Twitter that I've been seeing that are just like, look, your class is not your student's number one concern right now. They have a lot of other stuff going on, especially if they've just moved home, right? Or if they're in a different living situation. I think that's great advice, not just for now, but for all the time, because our students have a bunch of crap going on constantly. This is a conversation that happens every time I'm in or I help run or I sit in on a first year teaching practicum. So we have a course that we call Mentor Group that our students, that our graduate students and first-time instructors take the first time that they teach a course, be it professional writing or introductory composition. And there's always a moment where, you know, they say, my student, it doesn't have reliable transportation, or I have a student who's having suicidal ideation or has disclosed mental health problems to me. I have a student whose parent just died, right? And there's that realization that, oh, they have other things going on outside of my class. Maybe it's not the most important thing in their life. And that's just going to be magnified now. So recognizing that we all make mistakes, that technology is going to fail, that everyone is going to be on Zoom at once. And so it's going to be laggy and shitty. And we've got to learn how to deal with that. We've got to learn to be flexible and find ways around that and to understand that maybe we're not going to be at our best and maybe our students aren't going to be at our best. So it's not a time to reinvent the wheel of teaching or try a new and innovative approach per se, right? The metaphor that's circulating around right now is like, this is a lifeboat. So recognize it for what it is. It's a lifeboat. We're trying to get to the end of the semester. So being kind to ourselves, kind to each other, and falling back on those cornerstones of our teaching that we know to be true and that we value as writing instructors, right? We know good writing when we see it. That's our job. And so how can we do that, just not face-to-face with our students in a classroom or a computer lab or a conference space?
I come from India. It's not just a personal narrative that I'm trying to bring in, but it's the experience of a lot of people. We personally are seeing like what is going on in the world. We are aware of various developments. So it's all about like putting, it's not just, I wouldn't say, it's not giving the voiceless a voice. It's about Because these people have their voices. We just have to hear them. I don't think they're voiceless. They have a voice. We just have to develop a sympathetic ear to accommodate and hear all their voices. So that's what I think my objective is to bring in my teaching. So it's not just about like colonizing regimes. It's also about people. Like it's also about people with disabilities, for example. We need to hear them. Like probably we can't consider them as voiceless. They probably have a different way of expressing themselves. So it's all about being more accommodative to the world around. Make sure that everybody can say what they want to say, like creating a more balanced platform for everyone to be able to contribute so that we can enrich the curriculum and we can enrich ourselves with each other's experience. So that's what my objective is about.
What are some of the intersections that you see in your work with visual rhetoric and images with the work going on in writing studies, either where you're at or in another more global perspective?
Oh, it's quite interesting because the thing is like, if I can consider it from the vantage point of post-colonial scholarship, it tries to basically read against the grain and like enshrining into the era of ushering into the era of post-colonialism and decolonizing motives. Basically, we are also taught to read things against the grain in order to recover that voice which has been silenced. So I think in that way, my work, as it tries to recover the intentions of the subject populace, is very interesting. Like it matches very well with the writing studies agenda as well, to read against the grain, to look at the context in which something has been written and something which has been excluded, to try to find something which has been excluded from what has been given. Obviously, this does require a lot of theoretical and methodological sophistication. But given that, the whole agenda is to read against the grain. And also, this maybe is it is also important to think about writings of people who have traditionally not been able to participate in the Republic of Letters. Basically, so it's also about looking at third world literature as an example and how they interact and what they bring to the palette. So that's something which I find very fascinating because I myself look at a lot of post-colonial literature for my own work. And then I personally have to read a lot of text. I do research visuals. But then at the same time, I have to read a lot of published as well as unpublished records from the 18th century. And it's pretty much about reading them against the grain and trying to see what is not meant, what was not meant to be seen in there, and how our historical distance from a time and how the changing mentality enables us to find those voices which have been silenced in these writings.
Yeah. I'm going to quote here again. The Ignite presentations offer presenters the opportunity to briefly share their work. 60-minute sessions will include only 6 5-minute presentations. So what's the motivation to include Ignite presentations at the conference? And what does this unique format offer presenters and attendees?
Yeah. So I remember that came out of when I was first attending conferences. I remember I had so many good ideas that I wanted to propose, but I didn't really know if any of them, I'm like, man, can I really talk about that for 15 or 20 minutes? Like, I don't want to present some argument for 15, 20 minutes. What I want to do is really tell people like what I'm thinking about and get some feedback. And I say like, that's when I first started out, but honestly, like that, I feel that way now sometimes, like quite a bit, actually. I'm like, I don't want to go to a conference and make some long argument. I want to get some feedback on this idea that's just kind of starting. And I think we've all been there, especially like I mean, it all depends on timing. Like there are some times when you're working on something and you're ready to make a 15, 20 minute presentation or be a part of a roundtable or whatever else. But, you know, you might have some other project that's kind of in the middle where, yeah, you just want feedback and you just want a chance to talk. And that's kind of what that came out of is like for people who, you know, it's not that their idea is totally rough. I mean, it's they have enough of an idea that they want to present it to a real audience. It's not just a total like rough draft idea, but it's maybe something that they're not interested in talking about, like I said, for 15, 20 minutes, that traditional presentation format. The other motivation for those is we thought, well, if we could do several short presentations, that would give people the chance to hear from a lot of different folks in one session. So getting to hear, you know, 5-6 people at once, we thought would be really motivating for people, especially, you know, SWCA is really friendly to undergraduate tutors and you know, beginning graduate tutors. And so we thought, you know, for some of these folks who haven't done a conference yet, or, you know, maybe just gonna a couple, that can be really motivating getting to hear from that many people in one session. And we're, I should say, we're gonna do our best to, you know, to schedule those really strategically so that we have, you know, we have people who make sense together, I guess, in those Ignite sessions.
Episode 127 is such a cool moment for TBR Podcast. It's always gratifying to see how this podcast grows and new directions that it takes, new people that we talk to. I hope you enjoyed this inaugural best of episode of TBR Podcast. Thanks to Brandon for his hard work on this episode, this semester. Y'all be on the lookout for when Brandon publishes his next project as a part of the podcast. I'll be back next week with another new episode of the Big Rhetorical Podcast. Until then, always be listening rhetorically.
The Big Rhetorical Podcast is produced by Exalt Digital Media. Exalt Digital Media, not for profit. The Big Rhetorical Podcast was recorded on the land of many Native nations, past and present. These original homelands are territories of indigenous peoples who are largely dispossessed and removed. We specifically acknowledge the traditional stewardship of this land by the Wichita, Kickapoo, and Tawakoni peoples. Music for the Big Rhetorical Podcast is brought to you by DJ Lang, Stepha Helix, and Silva Jalgria.